Good morning to all of you. So good to be here to study and to be with you. The presence of God to worship and study from His Word. We're going to be studying again from the 20th chapter of the book of Acts. Now keep in mind that this little segment that we're studying about right now, these first six verses, there's a lot of information that's gleaned from surrounding passages, remote context, as it's sometimes referred to, this portion of Scripture. And so I want to try to finish that this morning and proceed on just a little bit farther. And Lord willing, perhaps we'll get to talk about that's down in verse 17, the meeting of the Apostle Paul with the elders of Ephesus in the city of Miletus. All right, Acts chapter 20, let's look at verse 1. After the uproar ceased, Paul, having sent for the disciples and exhorted them, took leave of them and departed to go into Macedonia. And when he had gone through those parts and had given them much exhortation, he came into Greece. When he had spent 3 months there, and a plot was laid against him by the Jews, as he was about to set sail for Syria, he determined to return through Macedonia. And there accompanied him as far as Asia, Sopater of Berea, the son of Pyrrhus, and of the Thessalonians, Aristarchus and Secundus and Gaius of Derbe, and Timothy of Asia, Tychicus and Trophimus. But these had gone forth, or gone before, and were waiting for us at Troas. And we sailed away from Philippi after the days of unleavened bread, and came unto them and to Troas in 5 days, where we tarried 7 days. Just lots of information in those verses. And in our studies so far, we've simply noted a few things about Paul traveling through Macedonia, his time in Greece, where he wrote the book of Romans, and we want to look at that in just a moment. Some of the acquaintances that we know from the book of Romans that he knew are identified there in Romans chapter 16. We won't spend a good bit of time on that, of course, but I simply want to note that from the map, his plans to travel and the course that he pursued. Now, here's the map that we've been looking at. And I want you to be very, very well acquainted. We have Ephesus here. He's traveled up to Troas, where he hoped to meet whom? Titus. And he did not meet with Titus. Titus wasn't there. And why was he hoping to meet with Titus? While he was here, he wrote 1 Corinthians, traveled up here, anxious to meet with Titus. Titus wasn't there. He traveled on into Macedonia, where evidently Titus does meet with him. And we studied last week from 2 Corinthians chapter 7 that Titus came and brought a good report. And things were very well. And Paul was anxious to be with them, and they were anxious to see Paul. And so things are very good. They have repented of their sin, and that's excellent news. Brought joy is the word that he uses to his heart. And so we want to take note of that. Now, following the travels of Paul on around through Macedonia, we've noted that Paul had written the 2 Corinthian letter from Macedonia on his way to Corinth. One of the things that we know that he has addressed in that 1 Corinthian letter was the collection for the needy saints in Jerusalem. He readdresses that as he is in Macedonia on his way to them. And we've noted that in 2 Corinthians chapter 8, commending them, or commending those of Macedonia to those of Corinth, the good things that they've done. And then, of course, in the latter few verses of the 8th chapter of 2 Corinthians, the writer tells us, whether any inquire about Titus, he is my partner, my fellow worker, verse 23, to youward, or our brethren, they are messengers of the churches. They are the glory of Christ. Show ye therefore unto them in the face of the churches the proof of your love and of our glorying on your behalf. Now, simply to note the text and the history that's involved here, that's easy to do. There are those, however, who have built a system of doctrine from these verses that I think are just wrong. They have alluded that or concluded, I should say, that the Apostle Paul had some kind of position of authority, and that these messengers who were appointed by the churches constituted some kind of authority. And Paul and this group of men constituted a board of directors overseeing these funds, therefore constituting some kind of a society through which these church utilized their wisdom and knowledge to disperse their funds. And Paul, even as in some cases by some people referred to as chairman of the board. Now that's a whole lot to get from this reading, isn't it? That's just not in there at all. But nonetheless, some have tried to develop, and may I elaborate just a moment, that some have tried to develop from this passage authority for churches of Christ to select a board of directors and engage in some kind of a centralized arrangement for the preaching of the gospel and for its work of benevolence and even for the work of edification. Now, while I'm paused on that note, just for those of you who may be unfamiliar with some of these arguments that took place back in the 1800s and on into the 1900s, especially in the 1950s and early 60s, these were some real grave issues. In fact, back in 1910, there was an effort by the church in Henderson, Tennessee. The elders sent out a letter. I won't spend a lot of time on this. I think it's just interesting because if we're not familiar with our past, we're likely to repeat it. And so we need to be aware of these things. The elders of a church in Henderson, Tennessee, sent out a letter to the churches of Northeast Arkansas, West Tennessee, Western Kentucky, and Southeast Missouri, inviting churches to send funds to them, that group of elders, who would then have the oversight of those funds, who would select preachers and select field of work and send these preachers around to various places in the world to preach the gospel. Now, that don't come out of this passage, and it certainly doesn't come out of any other. And that was refuted, and it did not happen because brethren stood. But then later, it did happen under the guise of an eldership in Abilene, Texas, the Fifth and Highland Church of Christ in Abilene. Some of you are familiar with this. Know the history. Some of you are not. But here's what happens when elders assume more authority than what God gave them. The authority that elders have is to the flock that has appointed them. No centralized arrangement, no centralized authority, no group of elders or board of directors that's overseeing a part of or the whole of the work of any other church except their own. And we need to see that. Okay? Well, the point being, we're familiar with some of these things. Randy?
One of the things that you see when you begin to look at the epistles that you don't see here in Acts is the collection of the money for the saints in Jerusalem.
That's true.
You see that, and I myself would wonder, why would Luke not include that in Acts? And yet, when you read the various epistles, like 2 Corinthians especially, and others, he's very interested in getting this collection to the saints in Jerusalem. And I think the reason, Paul is shooting from the hip here without any better information, is the reason that Luke wrote Acts.
Yes.
Acts was written as a sort of what we would call an apology in the classical sense of that word. It's an explanation. It's a defense of Paul, probably written to be presented to the Roman authorities during his first imprisonment. And therefore, if you were to have in here men who were collecting money, then it makes Paul out to be a mercenary.
Well,
I think that he left that out for that reason.
That may be true. Of course, two things. One is, keep in mind, the book of Acts is inspired. That end of story on that. Now, secondly, the book of Acts written by Luke is a book of history. And he doesn't record every detail of the history. This is an outline of 30 years of work. And so that's why I'm pausing here for just a moment here at these few verses in chapter 20 to insert some things that we gather from the epistles. Talking about this collection for the needy saints, at least two things I want us to note. One is it was directed by way of command to the church at Corinth in 1 Corinthians 16, 1, 2, and 3. As I gave orders to the churches of Galatia, so also do ye, that each one upon the first day of the week lay by in store as he has been prospered. Now, I've had folks argue and say, well, that was only because there was an imminent need of destitute people in the church in Jerusalem that's being addressed in that context. That is the only passage that tells us the time, the means, the how of the taking up of a collection. And so there are some details given in 2 Corinthians chapter 8 as we have prospered, indicates bountifully and cheerfully and that sort of thing. But what we want to note just here is that there's always a present need. Here is how the church gained its resources. And then secondly, the thing that I want to note is that those who were traveling with Paul were men who were appointed by the churches as messengers. Someone used the illustration last week, much like you would employ the United States postal system to deliver from point A to point B. You're not constituting a board of directors in the United States postal system that has authority over your funds. Their purpose is a messenger. They don't determine who gets what and how much. They don't get in the envelope and take out the money and distribute it at will. And these men did not either. What their purpose was to serve the churches that had appointed them as messengers to deliver from point A to point B. Secondly, I want us to note, was that two on second? Maybe this is third. What I want to note is that this was to the saints that were in Jerusalem. Now, a very important point just here. Keeping in mind that we're gathering information from the writing of Paul to those in Corinth from Ephesus, from Macedonia, as he's traveling on his way down to Macedonia, and then to Rome as he writes from Corinth the epistle to the Romans. Now, that sets it on the stage of travel for us. And the tidbits of information that we gather from these epistles is just grave information. We've looked at 1 Corinthians chapter 16. We've looked at 2 Corinthians chapter 8. In 2 Corinthians chapter 9, he, continuing the thought, said, "For as touching the ministering to the saints, it is superfluous for me to write unto you, for I know your readiness, of which I glory on your behalf, to them of Macedonia, that Achaia hath been prepared for a year past, and your zeal has stirred up very many of them." Now, we talked about that last week. Remember these first few verses where he says, "I've bragged on you to these of Macedonia, and there's folks down there, and I want to make sure it's ready so that when I come that you won't be embarrassed and I won't be embarrassed." And so we've got this whole scenario going on. But we want to note who it's for and who's collecting it. It's for the needy saints in Jerusalem. Now, while you have your Bible open there to 2 Corinthians chapter 9, drop on down in the text and let's read beginning in verse 12. Verse 12, 2 Corinthians 9, verse 12, and then we'll be looking at Romans chapter 15 in this sequence of passages. In verse 12, he said, "For the ministration of this service not only filleth up the measure of the wants of the saints, but aboundeth also through many thanksgiving unto God, seeing that through the proving of you by this ministration, they glorify God for the obedience of your confession unto the gospel of Christ, and for the liberality of your contribution unto them and unto all. While they themselves also, with supplication on your behalf, long to see you by reason of the exceeding grace of God in you. Thanks be to God for his unspeakable gift." Now, think. What I'm finding, and I'm not talking necessarily about you, but what I'm finding often when brethren begin to espouse error, they just don't think. think for a moment. The apostle has addressed those in Corinth in 1 Corinthians 1, commanding this contribution. Who was it for? The needy saints in Jerusalem. He revisits it in 2 Corinthians chapters 8 and 9. Who's it for? Needy saints in Jerusalem. Now hold your finger there, 2 Corinthians 9. We're going to come right back to it and turn to Romans chapter 15. We know that as he's writing Romans, he's writing from Corinth, and he's on his way with this collection for the needy saints in Jerusalem. Let's read it, beginning in verse 25. Verse 25. Romans 15. He said, "But now I say, I go into Jerusalem, ministering unto the saints. For it hath been the good pleasure of Macedonia and Achaia." Now, Achaia, who does that include? Corinth, yes. "To make a certain contribution for the poor among the saints that are at Jerusalem. Yea, it hath been their good pleasure, and their debtors they are. For if the Gentiles have been made partakers of their spiritual things, they owe it to them also to minister unto them in carnal things." Now hold your finger right there. Because the Jews had rejected the gospel had gone to the Gentiles. These up here in Macedonia and Achaia, as you see on the map. The very fact that the gospel is being preached to the Gentiles is indicative of the fact that the Jews had, for the most part, rejected it. But now this collection is for the needy among the saints in Jerusalem. The church, now, in Jerusalem. Who's it composed of? Jews. Now, we said that the gospel had been rejected, for the most part, by the Jews. But not all Jews had rejected the gospel. There's a church here in Jerusalem, and now they're destitute of this world's goods. There's so many of them, and they don't have the necessities of life. Thus, Paul is collecting funds on this third preaching tour to take to those needy brethren in Jerusalem. That's what he said in 1 Corinthians 16. That's what he said in 2 Corinthians 8 and 9. And you see that is his intent as he is writing this epistle to those in Rome. He's on his way ministering to those in Jerusalem. Now look carefully, if you will, at verse 28. He said, this is Romans 15 now. "When therefore I have accomplished this and have sealed to them this fruit, I will go on by you unto Spain. And I know that when I come unto you, I shall come in the fullness of the blessing of Christ. Now I beseech you, brethren, by our Lord Jesus Christ, and by the love of the Spirit, that ye strive together with me in your prayers to God for me, that I may be delivered from them that are disobedient in Judea, and that my ministration, which I have for Jerusalem, may be acceptable to the saints." Now, two things. Look at your Bible. Two things he calls upon the saints in Rome to pray for. Pray for me. Pray for me that I might be delivered from those that are disobedient in Judea. Judea is a province in which we find the city of Jerusalem. In this province, who's the dominant population? Jews. That's right. So there are those who are disobedient in Judea. Jews who are against him in Judea. But he's going to Jerusalem, city in Judea, to minister unto the saints. That is, Christians converted out of this Jewish background. And he says, I want you to pray for me that, number one, I might be delivered from the disobedient that are in Judea. But I also want you to pray for those among those needy saints that these funds will be received. Do you see that? Pray that it will be received. Now, let me ask you, Jared, pick on you a little bit more. I always pick on Jared. Why is Paul so concerned? Here's people that don't have the necessities of life. They don't have food to eat. And he's been collecting resources from all over this area, Macedonia and Achaia. And he's on his way to bring it down here to these folks. Why is there any thought in his mind that they wouldn't receive it? Good question, isn't it? That's what he's praying for. That's what he calls upon these in Rome to pray for. Here we just read it. Why is there any doubt that they might not want to receive it, Randy?
Because it's coming from Gentiles.
Yes. You see, that's the predominant thought. These folks down here are Jews. There are some who are obedient, and Paul's coming to minister to them. But the funds that have been collected have been from these up here, and they're Gentiles. And what kind of relationship did Jews and Gentiles have? Was this a problem even in the church? It obviously was. But now here's my point. I mean, there's lots of points in all of this. But here's a point I want us to recognize. When Paul is writing 1 Corinthians, who's the collection for? The needy saints in Jerusalem. When he's writing the second epistle to the Corinthians, who's it for? Needy saints in Jerusalem. When he writes the Romans on his way now from Corinth, who's it for? Needy saints in Jerusalem. Now you want to tell me when he gets down here to Jerusalem, he just gives it to whomever he pleases. Well, now that's a conclusion that many have come to. When he got down there, he and this board of directors just distributed it to anybody that they pleased. Now you know how they get to that conclusion? Let's look at 2 Corinthians 9 again. 2 Corinthians 9. We read verse 12, but I want to read again verse 13. Seeing that through the proving of you by this ministration, they glorify God for the obedience of your confession unto the gospel of Christ. Let's pause. Identify the players. Seeing that through the proving of you by this ministration, prove who?
The Corinthian brethren.
That's right. They're going to prove you by what? This ministration. What is that? That's this contribution, the collection for these needy saints. He said, they glorify God for your obedience. That is, they, the needy saints in Jerusalem, glorify God for your obedience. You who are Gentiles, you've obeyed the same gospel they have. And, he said, for the liberality of your contribution. How is it that these Gentiles who are Christians have given to those who are Christians who are from Jewish backgrounds? Liberally, bountifully, cheerfully. And he said, for your contribution unto them and unto all. Now, if you're reading from some translations, it says all men. You'll note the word men is in italics. And generally, if you're reading from a translation that uses that in italics, the reason it's in italics is the translators have inserted that to help make the meaning more clear. But I want to concentrate and focus our attention on this word all. I sat in an audience where a man made the argument that the term that's translated all or all men means all, universal, no exclusions, everybody, always. Now there are some instances where that expression does mean all men, no exclusions. But when the man tacked that word always on that, now that's where his error began. Because there are contexts where the same expression is used. That means all men, no exclusions, of a certain group or class. Now, for example, when Jesus gave his life, according to John 3:16, God so loved the world, he gave his only begotten Son, whosoever. Now we've got the compass here, it's just big. It includes all, everybody. He died for everybody. But, look at a passage found in Acts chapter 4. Acts chapter 4. Now, there are others, but we can look at this one. And just a rule of thumb, Jared, when you're thinking on these things, if somebody makes a statement to you that something never happens, never happens, all I've got to do is show one where it did, and your statement's not right. When somebody makes a statement to you that this is always the way it is, all I've got to do is show one exception where it's not, and your statement is no longer valid. Now that's exactly what happened. This man said the word is always used, and it's not. Look in Acts chapter 4. In Acts chapter 4 it says, and the multitude of them that believed were of one heart and soul, and not one of them said that aught of the things which he possessed was his own, but they had all things common. and with great power gave the apostles their witness of the resurrection of the Lord Jesus. And great grace was upon them all. For neither was there any among them that lacked, for as many as were possessors of lands or houses sold them and brought the prices of the things that were sold, and they laid them at the apostles' feet, and distribution was made unto each according as any one had need. Now, can you read that passage and come away with the understanding that those among the believers had all things common, and that those among the believers laid their funds at the feet of the apostles, and then just any and everybody that had any kind of a need benefited from that? It was distributed to everybody. Or is the all in verse 33 identified as those among the believers? Randy?
32 says the congregation of those who believe.
Okay. So we've got all of this class or group. Now take that thought back over to 2 Corinthians 9. With the history that we have behind it, the collection was for the needy saints in Jerusalem. It was admonished to be for the needy saints in Jerusalem. He's writing, commending the Macedonian brethren and the brethren in Achaia for their collection for the needy saints in Jerusalem. He's on his way to distribute it to the needy saints in Jerusalem. And then when he gets there, it's for them and anybody else they decide to give it to. Does that follow? Or is it for them and others among believers for whom it was collected?
I may be getting ahead of you, but when you begin to read that passage there in 2 Corinthians 9, and Paul goes on to talk about the effects of this gift, it then begins to not make sense if the all there is all men. By their there in verse 13, they will glorify God. So if all of men, or all others there includes men, then you've got Paul saying some things that just don't make sense. If you really believe that you give these gifts out to these worldly people, they're going to glorify God? I don't think so.
That's true, and there's another thought that I want to combine with that. You'll notice in verse 14, it says, while they themselves also with supplication on your behalf long after you by reason of the exceeding grace of God in you. What is it that the recipients of these funds are doing? You've mentioned glorifying God. What else are they doing? They're praying. They're praying. They're thankful for their brethren. Now, hold your finger there and go back to Romans 15. Now, these are passages I want you to be so familiar with that you just can't escape these conclusions. In Romans 15, the apostle has called upon those in Rome, brethren, to pray that he would be delivered from the disobedient, and that this collection would be received by those needy saints in Jerusalem. And then in verse 32, that I may come unto you in joy. No, that's not the passage I'm looking for. I think the passage I'm camping on is 2 Corinthians 9. They're praying, Randy. They're not only glorifying God, but they're making supplication. So these are folks who are in a right relationship with God. It's not talking about those simply of the world. Got confused there on which passage I wanted to draw from. But let us understand that the collection was for these folks. It was distributed to these folks. And to conclude that it was distributed to others is to make Paul out to be the biggest fraud that you could possibly have.
And this word that we're talking about here in 2 Corinthians 19 is translated all, or some translators add men. It's the Greek word pantas, P-A-N-T-A-S. And you have to look at the context to determine what the all means.
Well, that's right. That is the word that's used.
Certainly in Galatians 6:10, it means every man. That's not to be disputed there.
Right.
Because it goes on to say, I mean, do good unto all, especially those of the household of faith. Okay, all must be then all men. But the context has got to determine whether the all means
that's the key.
Or some class of within.
That's the key. That's the key. And that's a good learning tool. Whenever you come across the word all or everyone, read the context. Is it talking about all, everyone, a certain group? Or all, everyone of no exclusions? It's used both ways. And to say that it's always used this way is just a misstatement. It's just not an accurate statement. All right? Now, we've talked about Paul's plan. Let's go back to Acts chapter 20. Acts chapter 20. Any questions or comments on that? That's such a crucial point, because this question of institutionalism and centralization of power is just not taught in the Scriptures. Randy, and then Bruce. All right, Bruce.
Well, you know, from the very beginning, on the day that the church began, it's mentioned in Acts chapter 2, verses 43 and on down, you know, how that all doesn't mean everybody in Jerusalem, but it means all those who are now obedient to Christ.
Well, that's true. So sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. We need to examine the passage where it's used, read back a few verses, maybe even a few chapters, and see how it is used. All right. There's nothing further. I want to look just a little bit back at Acts chapter 20. Acts chapter 20. In these six verses, we've got a plan of Paul to travel. And you'll note that his plan is to go straight to Syria, but that's interrupted. In verse 3, he tells us, "And when he had spent 3 months there, and a plot was laid against him by the Jews as he was about to set sail for Syria, he determined to return through Macedonia." Now, I don't know anything about what the plot involved. It's not revealed. But all we do know is that he planned to go straight across here to Antioch. But he couldn't do that because somebody's going to try to kill him. And he goes back up this way. Now, there's all kinds of lessons, perhaps, that can be gleaned from that. We don't have to be stupid because we're Christians. Okay? Paul interrupted this plot to kill him by being careful, changing his plans, and going back up through areas where he had already traveled and therefore spared his life so that he would have a number of years further opportunity to preach the gospel. Another thing that we want to note is that he decided to go through Macedonia to Asia. Now, that's going to bring us eventually to Troas, as you'll see in verse 6, where we will engage in a discussion of the Lord's Supper. His travel plans, by the way, included where he was going to be on the Lord's Day. And we might take a note there when we're making plans for our travel. Where you're going to be on the Lord's Day. Paul planned to be here on the Lord's Day so that he could worship with these brethren. Now, there's another thing that I want us to notice before we begin to identify these people in these interim verses, specifically verse 4. But there's one fellow that we've just got to pick up at verse 5, and that is Luke. One of the things that we've noted previously in our studies a number of times are the pronouns that are used, us and we. When we keep in mind that Luke is the writer, sometimes we find the expression us and we, which would include Luke in Paul's company. We went here or we stayed there. Other times we find expressions that they went there, they went here, or they stayed here, indicating that Luke was not in their company during such times. So when you're studying from the book of Acts, little things like that just make the book much more helpful. It makes it, as I use the expression sometimes, to come alive to our understanding and Paul's going here and there. And we want to note that in Acts chapter 20 in verse 5. But these had gone before, and they're waiting for us at Troas, indicating that Paul was in the presence of Luke, and Luke travels with him to Troas. And by the way, this us and we, us and them and they and that sort of thing, we don't find that after this point. Just an interesting observation. You don't find that after this point, indicating that Luke was with Paul even as far as his journey to Rome. Okay? Yes, Carolyn?
In verse 4, where it lists all the names of those who accompanied him, and then in verse 5 it says, but they went on ahead. So we know that Luke was with Paul, but we don't really have any indication if anybody else was with Luke and Paul.
No.
No one else mentioned.
No, nothing that I'm aware of that's definitive. No.
All those in verse 4 went on ahead.
Went on ahead.
Luke with Paul, if there's anybody else, we don't know.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. Okay? All right. Well, I want to talk about some of these folks who were with Paul. We'll not spend a lot of time on this, but some of them we've been introduced to before and talked about them, and mention is made of them here in this passage. In verse 4, we read about Sopater of Berea. All we know about that is we can go back to Acts chapter 17 and begin reading in verse 10 of the church in Berea. The preaching of the apostle in the synagogue there in Berea, the establishment of the church, and note that there were those there who were more noble than those in Thessalonica. Their mind was to read and study and learn. And then some have supposed that this is the same man that's mentioned in Romans chapter 16 and verse 21, spelled a little bit differently. Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. But that's the supposition of some. And then Aristarchus, he's identified as being of Thessalonica. Now we know that he was that Paul was in Thessalonica before he came to Berea. And what happened in Thessalonica? Acts chapter 17.
Ran him out of town.
That's right. They didn't like his preaching and they ran him out of town. And so then he came to Berea. Now, Paul, not having had opportunity to spend much time in Thessalonica, though somewhat successful, they were not grounded. And his desire then is in 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, I believe it is. It's his desire to teach them more perfectly the things that they need to know and to complete their understanding and some things that he has not had opportunity to teach them. No, that's 1 Thessalonians chapter 3. I said 2 Thessalonians, I believe. 1 Thessalonians chapter 3. It's his desire, verse 10, to perfect that which is lacking in your faith. Now, keep in mind, valuable lesson here. Similar in fashion to what we are finding in Corinth. When Paul did not have a lot of time there in Thessalonica, being run out of town, he's concerned about how they're faring. And so he sent somebody back. Who'd he send? Pardon me?
It
was Timothy in this case. He sent Timothy back. And I want you to look, if you will, in chapter 3 of 1 Thessalonians. 1 Thessalonians chapter 3. And we'll just look at this a little bit. Beginning at verse 1. He said, wherefore, when we could no longer forbear, we thought it good to be left behind at Athens alone, and sent Timothy, our brother, and God's minister in the gospel of Christ, to establish you and to comfort you concerning your faith, that no man be moved by these afflictions. For yourselves know that hereunto we are appointed. For verily, when we were with you, we told you beforehand that we are to suffer affliction, even as it came to pass, and ye know. For this cause I also, when I could no longer forbear, sent that I might know your faith, lest by any means the tempter had tempted you, and our labor had been in vain. But when Timothy came, even now unto us from you, and brought us glad tidings of your faith and love, and that ye have good remembrance of us always, longing to see us, even as we also to see you. For this cause, brethren, we were comforted over you in all our distress and affliction through your faith. For now we live, if ye stand fast in the Lord. In verse 10 he says, night and day, praying exceedingly, that we might see your face and may perfect that which is lacking in your faith. Isn't that good news to read of such things? But Paul's concern is indicated in that he sent Timothy to find out. He stayed in Athens and sent Timothy back up there. Now, if you want to see that on the map, we've got one. See, when he came on down here to Athens, from Thessalonica to Berea, then on down to Athens, he sent Timothy back up there. Find out how they're doing. And now we've got good news Timothy come, and the report is good. So he has occasion to be refreshed. Now this is where Aristarchus is from. Aristarchus, as we noticed in the 19th chapter, is one who was traveling with Paul when he came to Ephesus and was taken into that theater. Remember? That held about 25,000 people, and bad things often happened in those theaters to those who were Christians. We note that he traveled along with Luke, with Paul, on to Rome, as we will discuss further in the 27th chapter. As Paul is writing what we sometimes refer to as the prison epistles, which are Colossians, Ephesians, Philippians, and Philemon. That's right. Wrote those four epistles during this first Roman imprisonment. Paul makes mention of Aristarchus as a fellow prisoner. And we find that he's described in Philemon, verse 23, as a fellow laborer along with Paul. Now, isn't that helpful to get some of this in place just by the mentioning of this man's name? Secundus, also of Thessalonica.
Okay, and before we leave Aristarchus and Secundus, remember there in 2 Corinthians 8 or 9, he's going, I think 8, where he goes on about how he tells the Corinthians he received support from the church.
Yes.
In Macedonia.
Yes, yes. This is in
the statement they first gave of themselves.
Yes.
So this gives you an idea of the, I want to say quality of the church, but for sake of time here, I'll use that word, how good the church was there in Thessalonica.
Well, that's right. That's right. And several of these churches in Thessalonica, which would include in Macedonia, which would include Philippi, along with some of these others. Yes?
You should correct your Philemon's reference to verse 24.
Okay, we'll fix that. Secundus, also a member of the church in Thessalonica. We've talked about that. His name means second. I don't know a thing in the world more about this man. All right. Gaius, we have three mentions of this name, not necessarily the same man. One of the things that we have learned in previous studies is sometimes a name is a common name in Scripture and applies to several different characters. Here we see Gaius of Macedonia, who was with Aristarchus, taken into the theater. We've talked about that already. And also talked about Gaius of Corinth, Romans 16. Gaius, the beloved recipient of John's third epistle, 3 John, verse 1. And we want to take note of that. All right. And then Timothy, beloved Timothy, young disciple. We've already been introduced to Timothy in Acts chapter 16. He was of Lystra, personally selected by the Apostle Paul, referred to as my son or my child in the faith, indicating a close relationship with him. He had fulfilled special and often dangerous missions for the Apostle Paul. And one thing that we must mention is in the writing of the book of Philippians, Paul makes special mention of Timothy, and we want to call your attention to that. In Philippians chapter 2, Philippians chapter 2, beginning at verse 19, he said, "But I hope in the Lord Jesus to send Timothy shortly unto you, that I also may be of good comfort when I know your state. For I have no man like-minded who will care truly for your state. For they all seek their own, not the things of Jesus Christ. But ye know the proof of him, that as a child serveth a father, so he served with me in the furtherance of the gospel." Now, does that tell us a lot of things about Timothy? I don't have anybody like him. None like him. Now, when you consider who that might include, that gives Timothy a very exalted place, doesn't it, in Paul's thinking. I don't have anybody like him. He cares truly for your state. We know that in the writing of 2 Corinthians, Philippians, these epistles that we have on the board, Paul mentions him as a co-author in the writing of these letters. So we want to make special mention of Timothy Also, we want to note that Timothy received two separate epistles from the Apostle Paul. One that was evidently written, most scholars think, in the interim period between the first and the second Roman imprisonment. But I think it's overwhelmingly clear that the second epistle was written to Timothy from his second Roman imprisonment when he anticipated being executed. And some very warm words related to Timothy in that epistle, where he desires that Timothy would come to me shortly. Come before winter. Bring the parchments. Bring my cloak. And we know that from the Hebrew letter that Timothy is evidently at some point later imprisoned. We also want to talk about Tychicus of Asia, a Christian from Asia Minor. And we were talking about this, Virgil, I think last week, about where, what part of the country this was. Western Turkey. I made a map, by the way, that I need to give to you. I have it on this series of charts, a modern map of the area that we're discussing. But we know that he was sent with the letter to the Ephesians. He's referred to as a beloved and faithful minister in Ephesians chapter 6. Carried the letter to the Colossians along with Onesimus, who was the servant of Philemon, the subject of that epistle. It was sent to Ephesus on another occasion, possibly to Crete on another occasion. Holman Bible Dictionary says that he died a martyr. So traditionally, that's all we know. Trophimus of Asia, a Christian from Asia, again, Western Turkey, from Ephesus, falsely accused and taken by Paul into the temple. That's interesting. We'll talk more about that when we get to Acts 21. Trophimus was a Gentile. And it was assumed by the Jews that were opposing Paul when he went there for the distribution of the funds to the needy saints in Jerusalem, that when he went into the temple, that he took a Greek into the temple with him, which was just a horrible thing. That would defile the temple, you see, which that wasn't true, but nonetheless, that's what he was accused of. And that's mentioned in Acts 21. He was left in Miletus, sick toward the end of Paul's life. We read about that in 2 Corinthians 4, verse 20. And by the way, an interesting point on that is, if the purpose of miracles was to alleviate human suffering, why didn't Paul just heal him? Well, that wasn't the purpose of the miracles, was it? But he was left in Miletus sick. Luke of Philippi, the author of this book that we're reading, joined Paul a number of times in and out on this second preaching tour. Third preaching tour remained with him on till he was arrested and then the journey to Rome. Rejoins Paul, as we've just talked about, and we've talked about the we and us. All right, now why were these folks traveling with Paul? I highlighted three passages I want you to remember. Why were these folks all traveling with Paul? Randy?
I want to, before we wrap that time here.
All right.
Before we leave these, I think it's something for us to make note of here on all these men that you just mentioned. So many of them were so helpful to Paul. They played critical roles in helping spread the gospel. Yet we don't, not everybody can be a Timothy or a Titus or a Paul. There's work to do in the kingdom for everybody.
Well, that's right.
And while we don't read the praises being sung over and over of Secundus and Tychicus and others, we know they were very, very helpful to Paul, and there's an awful lot to be gleaned in the way of strength and admonition for us in our roles in the church.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I've heard these characters referred to as the second team.
The B team.
And a lot to be said for that, not necessarily implying that they were of lesser ability. They're just less mentioned. Less known of them, but their place is a place of grave necessity and importance. Okay.